On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Casey Parks grew up poor in Georgia and Louisiana, skipped meals, pawn shop, repo man taking the cars. She never saw France or London, but now she's seen Africa. And she's here to tell you her childhood poverty was nothing next to what she's seen. Casey Parks is 23, an aspiring journalist. She was picked out of nearly 4,000 applicants to go reporting in Africa with New York Times columnist Nick Kristof. She got a passport and a plane ticket and a slingshot journey into Africa's backroads and villages, an overnight education in gunmen and dying women, and the facts of a different life. Now she's back to tell her story and Africa's. Up next on Point, Casey Parks, Nicholas Kristof, and Fresh Eyes on Africa. Joining me now from New York is Casey Parks. She went to Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi. She's now a graduate student in journalism at the University of Missouri, Columbia, and just back from a whirlwind tour of Cameroon, the Central African Republic, and Equatorial Guinea with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. Casey Parks, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
3,800 applications. Nick Kristof said, "Somebody come with me," and yours was picked. Why did you put your hand up for this trip, Casey?
I had actually been taking a class at Missouri about confronting controls of information, and the professor was really interested in international media, so we spent a lot of time studying like Pakistan and North and South Korea and China, and I started to realize that I had been so focused on studying the South that I really didn't know anything about international politics, and so I just really wanted to go, and it was a chance to go for free, and I really wanted to go anywhere, honestly.
This is not just anywhere, though. 2 weeks right into the heart of Africa and really into the back roads and the villages. You had quite some adventures there in that time and a lot of insight that you shared in a very heartfelt way as well on the blog. It must be interesting coming back. You know, lots of people come back from trips abroad and learn that nobody wants to hear from them. You come back on this high-profile trip, and everybody's talking to you, asking you about Africa. Does people's curiosity line up with what you learned? Do they want to know what you want to tell?
Not always. There are some people who really do, but even sometimes it's hard just in social settings to bring up, well, I watched a woman die, and this is what it smelled like, and this is what it felt like. But one of the more shocking things to me is when I got back, I went to go to my parents' house in Kansas, and I had bronchitis from being in Africa and being on a plane for 15 hours. Mm. And the doctor looked at me and said, "You just got back from Africa." And she said, "Well, if I go to Africa, I don't want to see any tragedy. I just want to see animals." And this is a doctor. And I really wanted to leave, but I really needed to get my bronchitis fixed. So I did not leave, but it's just weird for, you know, a doctor to say something like that. And a lot of people have been interested in hearing the stories, but it's sometimes easier to write about than it is to talk about. And I sometimes feel like when I do talk about it, I don't do it exactly justice.
It's a quick trip to a big continent. And Nick Kristof, I'm sure, didn't just take you to game reserves. In fact, we all know that from reading what you wrote there. But what is the balance, the sense of the balance you came away from Africa with, the balance of joy and despair, of optimism and pessimism? Here you are, 23 years old, looking at it for the first time out of the country. Where's the needle on your meter when it comes to Africa on those measures?
In one of my blogs, I wrote about how when I lived in Mississippi, a lot of national press about Mississippi was always bad. And while I was living there, I kept thinking, why won't people write about the good things? There's so many good things here. And I never really thought about why they're writing about bad things. I just got so angry. And when I first got to Africa, I mean, it's really, really tempting to just report the bad. And I think that reporters do that because they want to make things better, and so they report on the bad things. But I remember sitting with the Prime Minister of Equatorial Guinea, Prime Minister Mangwe, and he said to us through a translator, "Why do people only report on the bad things in Africa, or why do they only report about the bad things about Equatorial Guinea?" Equatorial Guinea is a country that has especially gotten a lot of bad press in recent books.
And well-deserved in no small part, given the historical record of ripping off its own people. They're the leaders.
Well, Equatorial Guinea has got some huge problems of bad governance, among other things. Mm. And he pointed out the door and he said, look, we've got paved roads now. We're installing, we have better schools. We're trying to work with this Tony Blair initiative wherein countries are more open about how they're spending their money. And
Is this the Millennium Challenge where they're saying money for openness, money for clean government?
Yes, I believe so. Mm-hmm. And so what they're essentially doing, I mean, Equatorial Guinea, right now the president is in the Forbes top world leaders as far as money goes. I think they listed him at $600 million.
In a thoroughly poverty-stricken country.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's a weird. I remember the first night there, this was Equatorial Guinea is the first place we went. And Nick likes to joke that I'm probably the only American whose first trip out of the country was to Equatorial Guinea. But I remember we were traveling through all these places that had no electricity. And then in the distance, you can see this huge Exxon city of just like tons of lights. It looked like New York in just the middle of Equatorial Guinea. But so there's a lot of oil money coming into Equatorial Guinea, but still a really, really poor place. But when he said that, I thought, well, he's right. They do have paved roads here. And I don't know if they're really going to comply with the initiative, but maybe they will. But I remember that. I looked at him and I thought, I know how you feel. I know what it's like to want that positive press. And so I decided right then, there are a lot of things that I decided on the first day that I had completely not decided before I went. But this was one of them, is that you can't only report the sad things that you're going to see. And I never thought that I would want to go to Africa and report about the good things, but so I made that decision, and I tried to, anytime I found something good, to put it on the blog. And I remember near the end of the trip, I felt like I just really didn't do a good enough job. There have got to be better things, a better optimism that I have not reported. And I felt really bad about that.
Mississippi Girl wants to do right by Africa, but it's not easy to bring a rosy balance out of this situation. Casey, describe just your trip for us. Cameroon, Central African Republic, and Equatorial Guinea, all in the space of 2 weeks. Give us the overview. Where did you go in? What was the trip like? What was it like traveling with a tip-top American news columnist abroad?
Well, I first arrived in New York. Our cameraman came down to Wichita, Kansas, where my parents live, and picked me up and took me to New York and to meet the tip-top journalist. I was really nervous at first. I mean, this is a man's columns whom I've been reading for a really long time, whom I really admired, and so I was really scared. I remember waiting in the hallway at the Times, and I knew he was about to turn the corner, and I was just so scared, but he walked out, and he gave me a hug, and he said, I feel like I know you already, and after that, I just wasn't really scared. He's a great guy. And really took care of me on the trip. So I, you know, he just felt like a normal person. I mean, an amazing person, but
you had written in your essay, I'm strong and have no need for 5-star hotels. I'm charming and sweet and considerate, but bold and fearless. you had really sung the song for him. He picked you up. Off you went. Where did you land? What were your first impressions?
I'm a little embarrassed about that paragraph, but we went from New York to Equatorial Guinea in this overnight flight. And we were only in Equatorial Guinea for a day, and we were just in the capital city. So I'm not, you know, so I don't have a greater sense of the whole country, but we interviewed the prime minister and we kind of walked around for a little while. And the next day we flew into Cameroon, and we were in Cameroon for quite a few days. And the trip for me, when I think about the trip, I think of being in a car on these terrible roads and bumping around. And at any random moment, Nick's going to say, pull over here, and we'll just walk through a village, and he'll just start asking questions of anybody, and that's how we found our better stories of Nick just saying, pull over, and we're getting out and starting to talk to people.
Did you feel overwhelmed? Did it feel familiar? Did it feel absolutely strange, like the other side of the moon? Here you were in Africa.
Well, the main thing that felt uncomfortable to me was the French. I took several years of French in high school and college, but there are things that you need to know that you in Africa that you certainly don't learn in college French. The first place that we stopped that we had to speak in French was a clinic, and everyone's talking about obstructed labor and midwives and breastfeeding, and this is all in French. And those are words you do not learn in college French, just absolutely not. And I had no idea what we were talking about. And this is another thing that I decided early on in the trip, is that if I didn't know it, I needed to start asking questions.
It turns out they were talking about life and death in this clinic. This is where the story of Prudence unfolds,
this is before Prudence, actually. This is several days. This is just another clinic that we stopped at that we didn't write about. But I didn't ask anything while we were in the clinic because I didn't want to, you know, going into the trip, I wanted to show Nick Kristoff. That paragraph kind of sums it up. I wanted to show Nick Kristoff that I could do this, and I was a great reporter. And that first day, I just decided, you know, this is a man who has so many resources for you and who can really help you. So get over your ego and start asking questions.
If you stand before an audience of 23-year-old Americans like yourself and tell them the most important thing you learned in Africa, what would it be?
The most important thing I learned about traveling to Africa, if I was going to teach someone about going, is just keep asking questions. You can't figure things out on your own in a place like that because it's a different country. You can't measure some place like that by your own expectations and your own experiences and your own language. So really, just keep asking questions. So I started to get the French a lot better. You know, I started to learn how to say HIV test in French and just things like that that you're not going to learn in college French. And we wound up in Yokodouma, Cameroon, several days into the trip, and that's where the clinic is, where Prudence was.
Casey Parks is with us from New York, and also with us for just a minute here is New York Times columnist Nick Kristoff, who selected her out of that big heap of essays. Nick Kristoff, thanks for joining us. What made you want to take a young American to Africa, and why Casey?
You know, I've been writing about these issues, about Africa, about Darfur, for, you know, years now, and it often feels as if you're heaving a rock into a pond and it just, you know, doesn't produce any ripples, it just sinks. And I thought that if I brought somebody along, and then, you know, especially a student, might be able to write in a way that other students would relate to, and that, you know, it would be a way of capturing a little more interest in these issues. Initially, I was going to take a student with me to Darfur, and then, you know, the Times lawyers sort of got wind of that, and so we recast the trip a little bit and went elsewhere in Africa.
Is there a message in this for other young Americans? Are you trying to send out some kind of radio wave to others here at the same time?
Absolutely. I just think it's incredibly important for anybody who wants to really be educated in a broad way to travel, and travel not only to Europe, although that's really important, but also to the developing world. You know, most people in the world today do live in the developing world, and I think that it's incredibly important that young Americans understand a little bit about what, you know, what that means, what a life in a poor country is like, what it means to live in a village somewhere. And, you know, it really is something that is feasible. Students can travel around Africa or India or Asia, and a lot of Australians and New Zealanders and Europeans do it, but not that many Americans.
Casey Parks, you ended up traveling with not just any American journalist here. Nick Kristoff has reported all over the world, a lot from China, a lot from Africa. He's been famously engaged and creative as a columnist, buying sexual slaves out of their slavery in Cambodia. You saw him get involved firsthand in Africa. What did you make of the way an American correspondent, now columnist, you know, does the work here, makes the sausage, finds out what's going on? What did you think of Nick's approach?
Oh, I learned so much from him. I learned, even when we weren't reporting, when we were just traveling, listening to him talk or asking him questions, I learned so much, even more than just about Africa. But as far as his approach, I learned that to get the story, you have to get out of the city, you have to go into the villages, and that you have to stop just randomly at people's houses or homes, you know, and just start talking to people, and people will speak to you. Before, I never would have imagined that you could stop at someone's home and just walk up and they would just start talking to you. And the other thing that I learned that I think was one of the best journalism things I learned is that even if we were reporting on AIDS, he would start asking them other questions about other stories we were working on, like maternal health issues. And we would sometimes find better stories in the side questions. And so I learned everywhere we went, I would hear him ask questions that I would never have thought to ask because they didn't seem on point exactly. And that was just a great thing that I think I'll keep with me, reporting even domestically.
And Dick, I know we've only got you for another minute. Let me ask you, do you see in a new generation of Americans, and I know this is a quick trip with Casey here, but, you know, there's so many stereotypes and kind of iron molds wrapped around Africa, into Africa, out of Africa, heart of darkness, and all the rest. Do you see a new generation approaching this continent and its issues in a new way, or are we perpetually vulnerable to those very old stereotypes?
I think we're always vulnerable to stereotypes of places we don't really know. That, you know, we see things through filters, and the way to overcome those stereotypes is indeed to get more people to travel there, and as well as more Africans, you know, to come to American universities and to build those kind of interactions. But I must say that I do think that attitudes toward Africa are changing a little bit. One of the reasons I think why more hasn't been done with it is a sense of hopelessness. I think that an awful lot of Americans just kind of write it off and think it's a tragedy that, you know, people are dying of AIDS and malaria and war. But, you know, Africa's always been like that, always will be. And so they just kind of wash their hands of it. And I do think that that attitude is changing. And I think the various celebrities who've now embraced Africa, I mean, I think they're, you know, they see where the curve is going, and they're ahead of it, and so I think that indeed we may be, you know, really at a sea change in terms of attitudes toward Africa.
Nick Kristoff, always mixing it up. Thanks a lot for taking Casey. Thanks for being with us for a minute here, Nick.
Hey, my pleasure.
Casey Parks, tell us stories. We've spoken several times about the story of Prudence who dies. Place us there. What happened? What does it tell us about that country, about this continent?
Again, Nick said, why don't we pull over in this random place? So he said, the next time we see a hospital, I want to stop there. So we stopped at this hospital in Yokodoma, Cameroon. And originally we were just going to go in to speak with a doctor about statistics about maternal mortality. And a nurse said, well, we have some women here you could speak to. So we found Prudence, who was only a year older than I am. She was 24. Mm. And she had been in labor for, I think, at this point, 6 days. And she had started trying to give birth in her village because she'd given birth to 3 other children just with the help of a midwife. And she and the midwife worked for 3 days, and she couldn't deliver. Mm. So the midwife actually sat on her stomach hoping that would push the baby out. But instead what happened is her uterus ruptured. At that point, her family gathered all the money they could and put her on a motorcycle taxi to send her to the hospital.
And at the hospital, when you found her, the fetus at this point had died, had expired. She was in big trouble, but nothing was happening.
Right. She had been there already for 3 days. And to get a cesarean section, which would remove the baby from her, would be $100. And so the doctor told Nick and I and our cameraman, Naka, that the $100, yeah, that was an issue, but what the big problem was is that she needed blood because she was anemic. And he said, you know, if I had the blood, I would give her the C-section. There's no blood bank because, he said, no one will donate blood there because they're too afraid of the HIV test they have to take before they can give blood. Mm-hmm. So you see issues here. So
turns out she was
together.
The same blood type as Nick Kristoff.
Right. So I'm asking just for facts of the story, mm-hmm. what blood type is she? Mm-hmm. And at first, no one even knew. It took them like 15 minutes to even find out what blood type she was. And they came back and said A positive. And I saw this look in Nick's eyes. And he looked at me and he said, well, I think I'm A positive. And that we looked over. I wasn't A positive. I was A negative, which at the time, none of us knew that negative can actually donate to a positive. But we looked at our cameraman and he was O positive. We all kind of got this look on our face like, is this what we should do? And so we asked, are the needles sanitary? And they said, of course. So Nick and Naka both said they would donate blood.
The nurse went to town for a plastic bag, and Nick or you writes, and in goes the blood. Prudence gets it. She revives for a time. There's talk of doing the C-section to help her out. The doctor vanishes.
Well, first he had to do 2 more operations before he could operate on her. Another main issue is that he's the only doctor. He'd been there since 7:30. Mm-hmm. At this point, I think it was about, he'd been there at 7:30 in the morning. At this point, it's about 6:30 in the evening. And he said, well, I have to do these two other C-sections. So we just kept waiting and waiting and waiting. And I asked Nick, I said, what is taking so long? I mean, it's been hours since he'd given the blood. And so we started asking around, and come to find out, the doctor's just gone home. And in some ways, you know, it's hard to blame him because he's the only doctor. And at what point does he say, okay, I have to go home? I noticed he had on a wedding ring, so I imagine he has a wife at home. But, you know, also if he had done the surgery earlier, she would have been better. I mean, she has a dying fetus inside of her.
And by the next day, she was dead herself.
So, well, she wasn't dead yet. She, the next day, he went at 5:45 mm-hmm. in the morning and did the C-section. But at that point, she's had a dead fetus inside of her for 4 days, and so she's now developed a terrible infection, and there are no antibiotics strong enough in the entire city to help her. So basically they said, you know, this infection will kill her. There are no two ways around it. And so we stayed a couple more days and just checking on her every couple of hours. And then we finally had to move on to a new city. And when we got to a city and we were in Bangui, Central African Republic, and we'd been reporting all day long. And I checked my email, and there's an email from a UN reproductive health expert who had been traveling with us. And it said, Prudence died at 5 p.m. today.
I wonder if you could read on in your blog from that point. You say, I see this in an email, and it should make sense. It should be what I expect. Can you read on?
I can. This is, as soon as I found out, Nick and Naka and I just all looked at each other, and I picked up my laptop, and I wrote this in 5 minutes and then posted it. Prudence died at 5 p.m. today. I see this in an email, and it should make sense. It should be what I expect. But I don't. That thud in the stomach is back. I've hashed through the reasons, though none of them make sense. Not together, not as individual pieces of blame. It is too easy to look at numbers of maternal mortality, or mortality in Africa in general, and feel distance from them. It is easy to think of death in Africa and not feel it close at hand. It's harder to see this woman as a daughter whose mother stayed awake for days at her bedside, whose eyes blared red from tears and no sleep. It's harder to see her as a mother whose children were at school when she left for the hospital in the back of a motorcycle taxi. It's harder to understand that in death there is a persisting struggle, a week-long fight through vomit and blood and infection. I have thought myself so humane in the past because my heart broke over the slightest glint of poverty, because I cared about genocides in other countries. Tonight, I read my email. Prudence passed away at 5 p.m., and I recognize the distances I have kept. I don't know how to live and have these realities constantly close at hand, but I know that I cannot live anymore with them as a story, as a facts and figures news article that speaks but does not move. I cannot hear of tragedies and blanket them under the term tragedy, because even that has become a cliche that is so easy to recognize, it's now too hard to understand.
Casey Parks reading from her blog there, written in 5 minutes in Africa after the death of a woman who she watched. And, of course, maternal death is so common in Africa. Case, we've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you. Let me turn to Aisu, calling from Boston. Hi, Aisu, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question for Casey now.
Yeah.
Casey, I've been following your blog the whole time you were in Africa. It was very interesting. I'd like to applaud you. And I was wondering how, you asked in your blog, how long does it take for fresh eyes to lose their gleam? Did you ever find yourself becoming numb to the images? And I was also wondering if you could comment on the difference between your gut reactions to everything you were seeing, you know, watching Prudence die, for example, as opposed to the reactions of Nick, who has been exposed to this type of thing numerous times and who still seems very emotionally affected by it.
Aisu, great questions. What do you say, Casey?
Okay, for the first one, hi, Aisu, by the way.
Hi.
For the first one, yeah, I remember near the end, we were in this little town in Central African Republic, and there was a store there, and the guys that were out there had on gold wedding rings. I mean, I don't know if they're real gold, but they were cooking a goat, and they had, like, canned powdered milk. And I remember at first I was like, all right, we don't need to stop here. These people are set. They got money. They've got powdered milk and a goat. And then I thought, I mean, that took me 5 seconds. I thought, what is your problem? These people don't really have money. Just because they have a goat and powdered milk, they still don't have electricity or health care or, you know, their clothes are all ripped up. And really, I'd been there like probably 8 days at this point. And so I just tried to like close my eyes really tightly and remember that this, you know, try to remember exactly what it felt like to see it for the first time. It's so strange that in 8 days only, suddenly I was like, oh, I've seen this. And I felt really ashamed of myself, but I imagine I'm not the only one who's ever felt that.
And Nick, who's been through it around this block many times, what about his emotional openness, his human openness to what he was seeing?
Well, when we were at the hospital with Prudence, I remember I was talking to her husband, and he looked at me and he said, my wife, she's everything to me. And I was just about to lose it. I had to go outside. And I knew I was going to start crying, and I just kept thinking, please, please don't cry in front of Nick Kristoff. He's seen this a lot of times. You're going to look so stupid if you just break down on the first thing and start crying. But, you know, I don't think he would cry at any of these things, but he's certainly still affected by them. And I remember just being amazed that he was still affected by them because he's seen a lot of things. But he was just as upset as I was, and I remember I can still feel standing in that hotel room, in the hospital room with him, and she had been vomiting up blood, and I remember he walked over there and wiped some of the vomit off of her face, and I remember the way he looked, his face, and he's still a man who's definitely affected by every small, I mean, that wasn't a small thing, but everything we saw, he's most definitely still affected by.
I Sue, what did you take from Casey's blog? Did it make you want to go to see firsthand?
It did, actually. It was very inspiring. I've actually been to Africa. I was in Tanzania, and the comment you made about your doctor, Casey, really struck me because I went on a safari to see the animals, and I want to go back and spend a lot more time with the people rather than the animals because that's really what affected me more from that trip.
I see. We hear it, and we're glad you're reading there. Thanks very much for calling today. Aisha's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Aisha. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just want to say thanks to Casey. I am from Sierra Leone, West Africa, and I know exactly what she's talking about. I've lived it. I've been through it. But my question is that going to motivate you to do a lot more, or is just this was an educational trip, or are you going to encourage your friends to go out there and see? Because from a younger mind's perspective, usually it's different because it's not distorted like other news media, just as you stated earlier, that some of them just want to report on the negative. I know there's few positives, but really I'd rather reporters focus on the negative because that's where we need the help the most. Just as your story that you seen the young lady die. Mm. But are you going to encourage, like, you know, friends, family members, classmates to get involved in this process? And again, I want to thank you very, very much for this eye-opener. Thank you so much.
Casey,
thank
what
you,
about
Aisha.
It?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think it's that you have to have the balance because if you only report on the negative, maybe people would think, as Nick said, that they just dismiss it. And if you give them some positive, it shows that there are changes. So changes are possible. Most of my friends aren't journalists, but I would certainly suggest that they go. We met some people up near Chad, actually, who were about my age, who were working with a Catholic charity that they had found through a Peace Corps website, not even through just the Peace Corps, but they were fixing wells in 139 villages, and these are people my age, and that makes a huge difference in 139 villages, not even just 139 people. The day that we were leaving, I was so ready to go home. I'd been eating, like, not very much food at all. I hadn't slept very much. I wanted to take a shower, and I just thought, oh, I'm so ready to go home. But it only took 2 days for me to say, oh, I'm so ready to go back. And there's been at least one moment every single day since I've been home that I thought I really, really need to go back. I mean, I don't have the money for the plane ticket right now, but I know I definitely will go back.
You wrote in your essay before you went out that you hoped in your work to break people's hearts so adeptly that they move into action. Nick Kristoff has done that in many corners of the world. Is that still a goal for you, and does it look doable? I mean, people's hearts get hardened as well.
Absolutely. I think he is a great example that it is possible. And I think the thing that separates Nick from a lot of other journalists is that almost every single column, he tells you a story like this, but then he tells you a way you can help. So you don't just sit there and have your heart broken at your computer screen and just get really upset. And that's the kind of journalism that I do want to do. I'm not sure, as a journalist, exactly how you can do that in an article, show a clear way to help, but I think it's certainly possible. And through this blog, the thing that I learned most is that the type of journalism I want to do, that sentence is so very possible, because there were so many comments on the blog that said, I had no idea, or I've seen this on TV and I just didn't care, and now I care. And we got a lot of emails of people wanting to send money to Prudence's family or to charities or to maybe even go over there themselves and teach English or volunteer with a clinic or anything. And I think the thing that I learned the most is that it's possible, absolutely.
To break people's hearts so adeptly that they move into action. Casey Park, stand by for a moment, if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation from New York, Jibril Diallo, a native of Senegal, lives in the U.S. now, co-chair of the World Affairs Task Force for America's National Association of Black Journalists. 2004-05, he was spokesman for the president of the U.N. General Assembly. Jibril Diallo, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for this invitation.
So here we've got a young American journalist in training. She's headed out to Africa full of enthusiasm and curiosity, and you can hear her enthusiasm for this trip. You've read Western and American media coverage of Africa for a long time. If you've got any guidance, any wisdom for her as she begins this kind of career, what is it? Is this the way to begin, and what are the pitfalls?
This is definitely the way to begin, and I really have been listening to the program for quite some time with Casey Parks. In today's world, the difference between generations is far bigger than the difference between continents, countries, and races. So I'm sure that Casey Parks on several occasions found herself very close to the youth in Chad, in the Central African Republic, and in Cameroon, than people who are much older than her, even across the United States. This is what we've been trying to do at the United Nations, to say that it's the unknown that brings about the difference between people. When people are together, when they come close together, then they can only respond to each other as human beings.
Well, what's your sense of the general picture that Americans get of Africa, you know, sort of writ large from the American media here? Are you satisfied with it? Is it accurate? Is it sufficient?
Well, it's two levels. One, I have lived in the United States for several years. Mm-hmm. As a citizen of Senegal, I have always been struck by the generosity and the response of the average American. People care. And this is something that strikes me. Where the problem is really we need to almost clone the Nick Kristofs of this world and have as many of them as possible. In other words, the stories of islands of hope of the type that Casey Parks is describing are not really making their way into the American media. Nobody wants to back a loser. Nobody wants to have their hard-earned dollar to go into a bottomless pit. And this is where the National Association of Black Journalists comes in as one of the largest media organization in this country. It brings across stories that any good journalist can have access to, not just once, but day in, day out.
Jibril Diallo, we really appreciate your perspective. Thanks a lot for spending a couple of minutes with us. Let me take a call from Dupay in Cheverly, Maryland. Dupay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
Casey, thank you. I'm an African in Nigeria, and I really appreciate your visit to Africa and reporting on it. One of the major things I notice is that there are millions of Africans outside of Africa, and most of us, we have good intent. The vast majority of Africans, I'm sure, like you've met, they are good people with simple expectations and hopes. But my thing, one of the things I believe is one of the huge albatross on our necks as Africans is this issue of corruption at every level. Government level down. It's not a shortage of resources that's hampering us. It's this albatross that we have, that these resources are wasted, they are pillaged, they are stolen by people who are supposed to be responsible to make sure it gets to where it needs to get to. And after a while, people just get numb to this kind of things that you see, because it happens so often every day in every situation all over Africa. I would wish that the international media and people like you, people like me, would go out there and talk more about the issues of corruption so they can help us to find ways to try and break that mold so that Africans and Africa generally can benefit from its own resources and our people can have a better life.
Mm. Dupe, our time is short, but thanks very much for that. Casey, how about it? Numbness or a spark of energy, of willingness to turn their own countries around. How did you see that spectrum?
Well, I think a lot of people that I met weren't exactly sure how to do that because a lot of, like how she just said, corruption does filter down from the top, and sometimes I'm not sure what just villagers can do about it. But you know how we were saying Equatorial Guinea is a perfect example of this, that a lot of money is going into that country, and Equatorial Guinea, you know, could really make a huge turnaround if the top was a little more right.
Upright, maybe. Keep the focus on that. There's some rough times here. You and Nick held up at gunpoint along with your crew there on the way in and out of one village in the Central African Republic. Were you ever frightened for your life?
Well, I was kind of scared when we were going up near there. I mean, we'd heard a lot of stories about being in Central African Republic near Chad. So I was already kind of scared, and we were traveling through villages where people had to actually abandon the villages and move into the bush because not only were there rebels with guns holding places up and kidnapping children, but now the army was burning down villages in hopes of killing off the rebels. So people are not only scared of rebels, but they're scared of their own government. And so we were going to try to talk to some of these people to cover it, and we're driving down the road, and all of a sudden two men step out with guns. And at that moment, I just thought, oh, no, I'm going to die near Chad. I'm not going to ever make it home. And I was scared. And then they came up to the window, and the guy said, give me some money. And I remember Nick rolled down the window. We were in the back seat. And he reached out, and he shook the guy's hand. And I thought, oh, my God, Nicholas Kristof, what are you doing? Why are you shaking this guy's hand? He's trying to take everything from us. And when he shook his hand, I looked at this guy, and I looked in his eyes. And he looked like almost every other guy that I had seen while I was there who was just looking at me, asking me for money, like he had no choice. And I just thought, I looked at him, and I wasn't scared of him. He still had a gun that he was pointing in through the window at us. But I just, in a lot of ways, I didn't blame him. I mean, other people were holding him up, I'm sure, and he had no money. And we were actually traveling with a Senegalese man who told us that the average wage there is about $2 a day. And though Our driver actually talked the bandits out of taking any money from us. We were in a two-car convoy. They got about $30 out of the car behind us. So right there you have like 15 days worth of work done, you know, in about 2 minutes. And it's hard. I was really scared. And the same guys actually held us up again about 30 minutes later.
On your way out of town.
On our way out of town. And they were a lot more angry then. I mean, the guy, there were two men, and they had their faces all covered up except for their eyes. But one of the men started loading the gun, and he was getting really angry. And that's when I got really scared. But I knew that Nick was really going to probably take care of me. But it's hard. Even though I was scared of them, I also saw them as victims of something else. So, you know, it's not a fear that stays with me, for sure. I'm more worried about that village than I am about myself.
Casey Parks, we're glad you're home, but we're more glad that you were there. Thanks for taking the trip, and we really hope that you keep your eye focused on that great big continent. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with available real-time traffic monitoring. More information at Acura.com.